The Holy Gospel according to St. John, the 8th chapter. Then Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." They answered Jesus, "We are descendants of Abraham and have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Very truly I tell you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not have a permanent place in the household. The Son has a place there forever. So if the Son makes you free, you will be free indeed." The Gospel of the Lord. In 1517, that famous monk named Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church. Part of the introduction to that document read, "Out of love for the truth and the desire to bring it to light, the following propositions will be discussed at Wittenberg under the presidency of the Reverend Father Martin Luther, Master of Arts and of Sacred Theology. Wherefore he requests that those who are unable to be present and debate orally with us may do so by letter." And it was that conversation that brought about a dramatic reform in the church, both in questioning the authority of the church, but also how the church views God. Brian McLaren, in his book, A New Type of Christianity, urges us to consider posting a new document on the doors of the churches, asking for a new conversation. And he writes, "It's time for a new quest, launched by new questions, a quest across denominations around the world, a quest for new ways to believe and new ways to live and serve faithfully in the way of Jesus, a quest for a new kind of Christian faith." If we are going to be God's people in this new time and engage in that new conversation, there are some parts of our religion that we need to take a serious look at. The first part of our religion to which we must cast a serious look is this belief, "I can't do enough." I was remembering this week a part of a quote from Dorothy Parker, who wrote about hate, and the quote had something to do with, "What are you going to do with your hate while you are diapering your baby?" And I wanted to find the rest of the quote because I knew there were a couple more sentences to it. And so I did what anyone nowadays does who is somewhat savvy on the internet. I plugged into Yahoo, "changing your baby." Now, I didn't get the Dorothy Parker quote that I wanted, but I did get 51,400,000 recommendations about how to diaper my baby. And it raised a level of concern for me because my son's 11. I thought, did I do it right when he was an infant? Did I change him enough or too much? Was I supposed to wake him up in the middle of the night and change him even though he was sleeping? Did I use the right kind of diapers? Because I don't want to, you know, leave my own carbon footprint on the environment because I used the wrong kind of diapers. Did I use the right kind of powder and enough of the powder? Did I do it gently enough or firmly enough? All of these issues were raised as I read this sum of the 51,400,000 recommendations about how to take care of diapering my baby. Now, we laugh about that, but at some level, we need to acknowledge the voices are out there. The accusing voices are out there. Look at the magazine rack at your local store. Your yard isn't what it should be. Your garden isn't what it should be. Your diet isn't what you should be. Here's the best way to make Thanksgiving dinner. Your abs don't look like they should look. And most of us, if we could see them, would probably recognize that. We don't run as fast as we should. We don't run as far as we should. We don't drive the kind of car we should. And we keep getting bombarded with these messages. We are not doing enough. Now, all of these sources then are willing to present themselves as the solution to the problem. So follow their technique. Follow their five easy steps. Live the way they tell you to live. And there are people out there who will put themselves in front of you as a solution to the problem as well. The experts, the leaders out there, that if you just do what they tell you to do, it'll make all of the difference. The problem is we try and we try and we try, but we can't do enough. Instead of realizing that we are just buying into this freight train of an accusing voice, whenever we don't live up to something, what we assume is that someone has done something wrong. So we start at some level resenting those who are getting in the way of things being made better. If only you would do more. And listen to how that conversation plays out. It plays out in the church. If only you would do more. It plays out in local government. If only the mayor would do more. If only the police would do more. If only the county commissioners would do more. If only the governor would do more. Thank goodness we have a chance to have someone who will do more as we get ready to an election, right? If only the president would do more. We fall into that trap. If someone would just do more, it would all work out. And that resentment can just in such an insidious way lead to a hatred of people who don't help us meet those expectations. And for those who don't have a level of self-control, that hatred can lead to the destruction of those perceived to be the problem. And so someone takes an axe to police officers in New York City, or someone shoots sheriff deputies in California, or a student takes a gun into a school in Washington, or you find a bullet on the floor of Manheim Township School, and you realize we want to destroy those who aren't giving us what we think we need. Can't do enough. The part of our challenge in redefining the church is having the courage to take on these accusing voices that say you can't do enough and realizing how it is violating human life. Another challenge we take is looking at the different ways that different generations look at their spiritual lives. Robert Wuthnow, in his book After the Baby Boomers, asks us to take a serious look at the difference between the baby boom generation and older and the millennial generation, those in their 20s and 30s. And he says that the church is really based on a mindset of people who are 65 and older. Even the programs of the church are geared upon that worldview. He is that it's based on the belief that life comes to an end around 70 to 75. And if that's the end of life, then the structure of life is shaped from that. So what we expect is that we have children who go through elementary school, junior high, senior high. They go to college. They graduate from college. They immediately get married. They have children. And then they immediately move right into adulthood, into the church. And they fit right into all of the programs that we have in the church. And if you look at how the church life is structured, we target and we work our ministry based on those structures. But what Wuth now says is there's a change in understanding of the longevity of life. And so we don't see people now getting married after they get out of college, because first and foremost, people are not convinced that they will get a job when they get out of college. And so they're concerned about their well-being. They put off getting married until the 30s at the earliest, into their mid-30s, and then consider the possibility of having children. And so what happens in the church to that population of people who are single and don't have children? There's no church program in place for it, because our programs are modeled on an older model of ministry. Wuth now goes on to say, we also need to look at the difference between the generations spiritually. He says, for the most part, those in the older generations, their spiritual concern is, will I make it to heaven? The younger generations, their spiritual concern is, how do I make the world a better place? See the difference between the two. And so you have both groups of people trying to be faithful and trying to do the right thing, but they don't match up. So it sets us up for a battle of generations within a congregation. Really fascinating to me that I'll hear from the older members of a congregation, we need to see more young people in the church. And yet as soon as we target and we start reaching the young people, they say, you're not paying enough attention to us. You see the trap? It sort of makes you go, blah, blah, blah. In the most recent edition of our national magazine, The Lutheran, it talks about this huge wave of pastors that are getting ready to retire in the next 10 to 15 years. And one bishop was quoted as saying, the problem is when they all retire, we lose our best pastors. What does that make our associate pastors? So it's a sense of something's wrong if we're not making it work for our generation. But it's the same reason then that the younger generations will say, I'm spiritual but not religious, because they don't fit into the model of how we structure the church right now. So the new conversation includes how we deal with the generation gap in the church. And third, the challenge we face in the congregation is to realize that every single one of us sees the world through our own personal biases. Murray Bowen at the National Institutes of Health many years ago started looking at the human brain. And as he looked at the human brain, he realized there's part of the human brain that we share with reptiles. There's part of the human brain that we share with mammals like dogs. And there's a part of the human brain that's unique to human beings. And the hope is, as a person is fully human, they're using the whole and complete part of their brain. But what he goes on to hypothesize is that the more you're under a fear, the more anxious you are, the more likely you are to start using the lower levels of your brain. So if you are afraid, you'll start using the dog section of your brain and you'll want to pack up with other dogs just like you and be around people who make you feel safe just like you are. Or even if the fear level continues, you function more like a reptile. We either destroy or whether you run away. And it set the tone then for a wonderful field of neuropsychology that's exploding right now with works from Steven Pinker and How the Mind Works and Daniel Kahneman and Fast and Slow Thinking and Jonathan Haidt and The Righteous Mind, which tells us that the way we think has two parallel processes in work. There is one which is highly emotional. And as soon as we feel something about someone or a situation, we draw a conclusion right away. And there's this slower, more logical section. It says, we think we're logical beings, but most of the time we function on the emotional level. And what we do is once we draw our conclusion emotionally, we lay the logic over it and then assume that we were right. And once people have made those decisions, it's virtually impossible to change their minds. We all bring a bias, a filter, a prism through which we see the world. If I say the word orange to you, we will not get 100% agreement on what you think of when you hear the word orange. Some of you might think color. Some of you might think fruit. Some of you might think juice. My wife thinks one of the colors of the Cleveland Browns, which trounced the Pittsburgh Steelers a couple weeks ago, and she keeps pointing that out to me repeatedly. If you're Ben Seldenridge and you go to Syracuse University, you think that's the name of your student team, is the Syracuse Orange Men. If you watched infomercials a couple years ago, orange is that secret ingredient in the cleaning things that makes everything go away in your house. My wife tried it on me. I'm still there. And so there are all of these visions of orange. It's the filter. It's the prism, the bias through which we look at the world. None of us will ever look at the world objectively. But we will all draw conclusions based on our own biases and perceptions and then come up with good reasons why we think that's the right thing. And that becomes our stumbling block to coming to faith. We like to think that we'll come to believe in God all on our own, that we have free will, and we do have free will in the sense that we can choose where we go. So my free will is exercised when I go to a certain restaurant, and I exercise it in what I choose. Jesse exercises his free will at a restaurant by taking 20 minutes to decide because he wants to consider all of his options. So if you take him for lunch, allow extra time for that lunch. But when it comes to believing in God, we will not on our own come to faith in God. Because if we more serve ourselves than God. And that's why Luther, in his explanation of the third part of the Apostles' Creed, says, I believe that by my own understanding or strength, I cannot believe in Jesus Christ my Lord or come to him, but instead the Holy Spirit has called me through the gospel, enlightened me with his gifts, made me holy, and kept me in the true faith, just as he calls, gathers, and enlightens and makes holy the whole Christian church on earth. That it's God who brings us to faith. So what's the use? We can't buy into a technique and do enough to make our lives right. What's the use? And what's the use if the way that we see the world through our own generations is biased to serve our own needs? What's the use? And if we can't come to faith in God all on our own, what's the use? And I think that's a fundamental spiritual dilemma under which we all live right now. What's the use? I do everything I can to keep my son safe, and yet he could go to school and be injured or killed. What's the use? I teach my son that even though he's biracial, he is just as good as any other white person in the world, and then a kid comes up to him in school and uses a racial slur. What's the use? and take the risk to love someone and marry someone, and then that person turns around and cuts me loose and abandons me. What's the use? I take care of myself. I try to be healthy, and I end up getting sick or there's something wrong. What's the use? Keep asking that question repeatedly. What's the use? That's rooted in optimism, that somehow we can make something happen now that will bring about a good result in the future. What I want to put in front of you is, instead of optimism, the concept of hope. And hope is when the future breaks into the present. Hope is when the way the world is going to be under God's command breaks into the present. And we believe as Christians that hope breaks into the world the moment that Jesus dies on the cross. When the very worst of humanity exhibits its fullest power. And notice, it does not bring everything to an end. But in the end, God raises Jesus to show us the way God has created us and has created the world. It's hope because we believe that there is going to be a time when those that we have lost to death will be raised from the dead. It's hope in the sense that as we yearn for those we have lost to death, that we will be reunited with those who have gone into death. It's hope for a moment that those who are sick and in pain will be healed, never to suffer again. It's hope for those parents who have lost children through violence. It's hope for those who have had broken relationships that God is going to set things right. That is our Christian hope. And that is what reshapes the church. We are called to witness to that hope. I remember a while back, as my wife was going through her treatments after her brain tumor, a member of our congregation who's a physicist in the radiation oncology department, as Connie was going through a treatment, comes out and checks on me to make sure I'm doing okay. A physicist witnessed to me. And while my wife was in surgery back in 2012, a number of the surgeons and physicians in our congregation came time and sat with me during that day, and they prayed with me. They witnessed to me. But it's not just those professions that are considered to be above and beyond everything else. It was this past spring, just after Easter, I go to the dry cleaner to pick up my dry cleaning. And Peggy, who's one of those crusty ladies who has the voice that sounds like she smokes cigars and drinks whiskey all the time. I love that sound of her voice. As she's checking me out, she pauses and she looks me in the eye and she says, "Are you okay? Because you look tired. And your family, your wife, and your son need you. I think you need to rest." She witnessed to me. To witness to a God who is taking charge of the world and setting it right. Amen.